For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show we have two Antipodean authors, a Jamaican, an American, and a Sri Lankan, with one thing in common. They've all won the Booker Prize. A version of this show was meant to go out before the Booker Prize, but was dropped as the nation's media mourned the loss of Elizabeth II. But not one to shirk my recycling duties, I've cut it up and put it back together again, so we can now hear from this year's Booker winner, Sheehan Karuntilaka, and the books of his life. But first up is Marlon James with his book, A Brief History of Seven Killings.
We see and wait. Two men bring guns to the ghetto. One man show me how to use it. But ghetto people used to kill each other long before that. With anything we could find. Stick, machete, knife, ice pick, soda bottle. Kill for food, kill for money. Sometimes a man get killed because he look at another man in a way that he didn't like. And killing don't need no reason. This is ghetto. Reason is for rich people. We have madness.
A clip from A Brief History of Seven Killings by Marlon James. Marlon joined me on the line and told me about the book.
A Brief History of Seven Killings is loosely based on the assassination attempt on Bob Marley in 1976. And it was me trying to answer what happened to the men. Well, they're really boys. What happened to the boys that tried to kill him? They kind of vanished. From the landscape pretty much soon afterwards. And I was always interested in what happened to them. Jamaica has hundreds and hundreds of lost boys. And these were the seven that I became really fascinated with. Were they really lost? Did they disappear? Who disappeared them? And in looking at it, it was also my way, my device, to figure out the 1970s, the 1970s in Jamaica. We had just, it was 10 years after independence from Britain, but we were caught up in the Cold War. Our economy was in shambles. There was so much violence, and I wanted to try to make sense of all of that.
What age were you when this was actually happening?
I was 6.
So what kind of awareness did you have at the time?
My experience of the 70s is totally different from my parents. For me, the 70s was a world of wonder. It was a world of TV being on in the day. It was Sesame Street. It was all these new American foods. In a bigger sense, it was the United States replacing the United Kingdom as our primary cultural and social influence. And my childhood was, persuading your parents to buy you a cool bicycle. So it wasn't, and my parents were very good. I mean, it helps that they were both at one time police, but they were very good at keeping us away from most of that. So growing up, becoming an adult and being aware of the world as an adult, I suddenly realized there was a whole 70s. There's an entire decade that I had no idea of what really happened. So in some ways, it's trying to reclaim that past that I was a part of, but it turns out there are 100 different kinds of past.
Now, the book is told by multiple narrators, and we know there's an audio version of it. Do you think it's one of these books that's better if you listen to rather than read?
That's a good question, because I think even when you're reading, you're listening to it. One, because I'm very much, and it's my second novel, that's pretty much told all by voice. And there's something about the orality of literature that I've always liked. It's like they did a new translation of the Torah, and you can tell the person remembered that the original five books were written to be spoken, people to be listened to, not to be read. And that changes everything. And so it's to me, even when it's written, to me, I more imagine somebody listening to it than reading it. So in that sense, not just the audiobooks make sense, But it also, you know, we're doing a TV script, and much of the lines remain the same, because voice is very important to me. Dialogue is very important to me. So I knew the audio would be very important.
Are you hearing the voices in your head as you're writing them down?
Yeah, and I think you have to. I can tell when a writer doesn't. this is not every writer is a dialogue guy, and you don't have to be. But it's very important for me that I have a sense that the characters are participating in their own story. And so far, it doesn't always have to be the case, but so far for me, it means them telling it. So I do hear their voices. And when I was listening to the auditions for the audio tape, that's what I listened for, what clicked, what sounds closest to what I had in my head.
Mm. So you actually got to choose the voices?
I did get to choose the voices. They sent me a bunch of, quite a few audio samples of different performers. Some with an understanding of Jamaican, some which didn't sound Jamaican at all. It sounded African. I think they thought that could pass. So it's like, no, they have to sound, the Americans have to sound American and the Jamaicans have to sound Jamaican.
Did you think about doing one of the voices yourself at all?
No. I've never I have three audiobooks now and I've never voiced them. Funny enough, my previous two audiobooks were voiced by a woman. Yeah, and this was multiple voices, but because it's more, when you're doing an audiobook, I think you're not just reading, you're acting.
But you're also trying not to do a performance of the book. There's a very fine line, I think.
But I think it also, again, depends on how vivid a world you want to paint. It's funny, because I teach creative writing, and one of the things that I realize, certainly with beginning writers, is there's an over-reliance on sight as a sensory detail. So, like I would say, I'll walk into the class and go, what did 9/11 smell like? There's too much of an over-reliance on sight detail, I find, because it's the first thing you think of. But Azir Nafisi, for example, the reading Lolita in Tehran, uses a lot of sound. An explosion is not something they see. An explosion is a rumble that they hear in the basement and a noise. And only when they run upstairs, they see smoke. So you don't even see the explosion, you feel it. And that was also very important to me. There's a scene at the beginning of the book where an American journalist is talking about the ghetto in Kingston, and he only uses smell. So, which is not to say sight and visual details aren't important, but there's a lot more to the sensory experience of a scene in a novel than that. And that was very, very important to me.
Madness that make you follow a man in a suit down King Street, where poor people never go, and watch him throw a sandwich. Chicken. You smell it and you wonder how people can be so rich that they use chicken for just to put between sauce of bread. And you pass the garbage and see it, still in a file, and still fresh. Not brown with the other garbage and no fly on it yet. And you think, maybe. And you think, yes. And you think you have to, just to see what chicken tastes like with no bone. But you say you're not no madman. And the madness in you is not crazy people madness, but angry madness. Because you know the man threw it away because he wants you to see. And you promise yourself that one day Rude Boy gonna start walking with a knife.
A Brief History of Seven Killings by Marlon James is available in Braille and as a talking book. For more information, head to www.rnib.org.uk. You're listening to a special edition of Read On featuring some of my favourite Booker winners. Next up, Richard Flanagan with his book, The Narrow Road to the Deep North. He joined me on the line and told me about the book.
It's a love story, I guess, which spans about 70 years of one man's life from the early 20th century through to the 1990s, and has as its centre one day in a prisoner of war camp on the Death Railway in Thailand in 1943. But I guess it's really a story about love and death, all the great verities, really. It centres on a character called Dorrigo Evans, who's surgeon who ends up being the leader of a group of POWs, but only because that's what the other men expect of him. He feels himself to be something of a fraud and a sham. And after the war, he's celebrated as a war hero, and he feels ever more false about the accolades that are heaped on him.
Now, tell us about your personal experience of the railway, though.
Well, my father was a survivor of the Death Railway and of being a Japanese prisoner of war for 3.5 years. I guess I grew up as a child of the Death Railway, and I absorbed much, as did my, I was one of six, as did my brothers and sisters, and you end up carrying strange things within you. And I realised at a certain point that I would have to write a book about those things and try and divine what they meant. And that meant I would have to do it as a novel. And the novel's not a fictionalised account of my father's experience, because to come to some understanding of it, to try and understand what it was, I needed to invent a story. And so the characters and the situations are different, although they're informed by my father's experience.
Before you were a novelist, in fact, when you were a child, how aware of your father's past were you?
Well, I always knew he was a prisoner of war, a Japanese prisoner of war. I mean, the book's dedicated to prisoner Sambiyako Sanchigo, which was his Japanese prison number, 335. I learned to count to 10 in Japanese very early on. It was never anything hidden or unsaid. He was unlike many returned ex-POWs who didn't talk about it at all, which seems to have been very common. But I think in truth he talked about it in a certain way, and it was, you know, there were stories of compassion and camaraderie, and that they were tales leavened with a certain pity, but also with great humour. He didn't like what he called the horror stories, but I think when you look at it, you have to admit it was a horrific circumstance that these men found themselves in, working on the Death Railway, which was, you know, one of the great war crimes of the Second World War. Over 250,000 slave labourers building this railway, of whom over 100,000 perished. More corpses than there are words in my book. More corpses than the bomb created at Hiroshima. It was a terrible thing.
Now, knowing what your father went through, was it hard to write the Japanese characters in the book with humanity and sort of sympathy as well?
Well, a lot of people ask me this, Robert, but in truth, perhaps the monsters are closer to us, you know. They weren't so hard, because I think it's always convenient to think evil wears the face of another, but in the end, murder, hate, evil, these things are buried as deeply within human breasts, perhaps even more deeply than love, kindness, goodness. And the truth is, perhaps those things are terribly entwined and difficult to disentangle. And the great crimes of the last 100 years have so often been done not by wicked men or women, but by the very best of people who believe they were, that their sense of their own goodness demanded they do things for some supranational or super religious or super political idea of goodness. And at that point, their lives oddly ended up in service of some of the great crimes of our age. That led me to view the Japanese characters not as people very removed from me, but as people very close. I suppose we have to be honest and admit that evil is the face we see in the mirror as much as also as love is.
How was your real-life meeting with the equivalent of your character, Commander Nakamura, with the lizard?
Well, I near the end of the writing of the novel, I went to Japan and I tracked down some of the surviving guards of the Death Railway, and because it was such a vast project, I didn't expect to meet anyone who'd been at my father's camp, but as it turned out, I met three or four of them, including one who'd been the Ivan the Terrible of the camp, a man known to the Australians as the Lizard. And that was a very strange meeting, because I only realised about 5 minutes before I arrived at this meeting in a taxi office now to suburban Tokyo that this man was in fact the Lizard. He'd changed his name back to his original Korean name rather than the Japanese name that I knew him as. The Lizard you know, a man who was sentenced to death for war crimes at war's end, had it commuted to a life sentence and then was released in the general amnesty in 56, was now a genial, gentle and gracious old man who endeavoured as best he could to answer my questions over an hour and a half or so. And finally, for reasons I still don't fully understand, I asked him if he would slap me. Slapping was the principal form of punishment in the POW camps, or certainly the most immediate and the most common, a very violent and continuous slapping. And he thought this rightly was a very curious request, but finally he agreed and we stood up. And he knew how to slap, you know. He positioned his body, you know, to get maximum effect. He cupped his hands. He slapped me three times, and on the third slap, the whole room began to sway and shudder and rock. And I thought I was going mad. But in fact, what was happening was that a 7.3 Richter scale earthquake had just hit Tokyo. And as this room swam up and down, I looked at this frightened old man, and I realised wherever evil was, it wasn't in that room with us.
Did your father know about his release in 56, and how did he feel about that?
My father knew he'd escaped punishment. Well, he had a certain period in jail, I guess. He didn't know he was still alive. When I returned to Australia, I told him that I'd met several prison guards, including the Lizard, and that all of them. I said that I didn't think they felt guilt, and I don't think they did. I think guilt is a higher concept, and you know, it's difficult in Japan to feel guilt for many people when the Allies kept the Emperor there as the at the apex of Japanese society, when all these people felt that all their acts were an expression of the Emperor's will, and that the Emperor was this deity who fully expressed the Japanese spirit. But I think they felt something more fundamental, and that was a certain shame, a deep shame. And all of them asked me to passed on apologies for me to pass on to my father. They all said they were sorry for what he and his fellow Australian soldiers had experienced.
Mm.
So I told my father that when I returned, and he was very old by then. He was 98, but his memory was still very good, and his mind was still very sharp. But later that day, he lost all memory of his time in the prisoner of war camps. That was a strange thing, because he retained all memory of life before the war and immediately after the war, and of the war itself, but not of being a POW. And it was, as my sister said, as if he were finally free.
Is the book going to be released in Japan?
Yeah, it will be released in Japan. My books have always been published there, and they have a good following there, and my Japanese translator was a great help to me in writing the book. I think we make a mistake thinking that Japanese people were closed to these stories. It is the case that they haven't been exposed to them that much. But, you know, I encountered great kindness and generosity and interest as I travelled through Japan. And my translator feels, as do other people I know in writing and publishing in Japan, that the book will be well received.
Now, as I said, your book's now available in Braille and in giant print and in audio for everyone. Is it important to you that your book is accessible?
Oh, yeah, completely. That's why I thought it was very sweet when you said that at the beginning, and I hadn't realised. Yeah, books are the great democratic art form, you know. So sometimes you're doing signings and people say, I haven't got a copy of your book, I borrowed it. I'm very sorry to say I borrowed it from a library. But I think that's a beautiful thing, you know, because most art requires you to live in a great centre and have access to money. You need a lot of money to see theatre, to see opera, and to see a movie. To, you know, the great art galleries are in the great cities, and to get to them you need money. But books are the great democratic art form. They're available everywhere, the best of them. You can get them for nothing from a library, or people will lend them to you because they're not really worth anything much, not like a great painting or something like that. And the 1 millionth paperback version, or the Braille version, or the print handicap version of my book, or of a great book, is just as valid, just as original, just as unique as the very first edition, the very first, the manuscript as it left the writer's hand. So, I think the more books available to the more people, the better the world is, because novels are one of the great human inventions. It's one of the great traditions we have of understanding ourselves spiritually, intellectually, aesthetically. And I think it's always a not just a beautiful thing, but a necessary, important thing that they be available to ever more people. I mean, the rise of democracy, the rise of a world that becomes a better place is linked with the rise of people being able to read.
In his old age, Dorrigo Evans never knew if he had read this or had himself made it up. Made up, mixed up, and broken down. Relentlessly broken down. Rock to gravel to dust to mud to rock. And so the world goes, as his mother used to say when he demanded reasons or explanation as to how the world got to be this way or that. The world is, she would say. It just is, boy.
Richard Flanagan reading from his Booker shortlisted book, The Narrow Road to the Deep North, available now from RNIB.
Next up on this special read-on featuring some of my favourite Booker winners is George Saunders. His book, Lincoln in the Bardo, has a rather unique audio version. But first, he told me about the book.
It's a novel and it all takes place on one night. And the idea is based on an anecdote I heard many years ago, and the anecdote is this. Abraham Lincoln, when he was president during the Civil War, lost his son. His 11-year-old son died of typhoid. And the newspaper accounts at the time said that he'd been so grief-stricken that he actually went into the grave, or the crypt, on several occasions to sort of interact with the body. Some accounts said he actually picked it up. So I heard that about 20 years ago, and it just stayed with me all this time, and I, you know, didn't really think I could write it. And then about 2012, I just decided that, you know, if it had been on my mind that long, I should give it a try. So the book is really just that night on which Lincoln comes to this place called Oak Hill Cemetery in Washington, D.C., and he enters the crypt, and then, you know, hilarity ensues.
Now, you're not known to be a religious writer, but what is a bardo?
Well, bardo was a Tibetan word that means transitional state. So we're in one right now, you know, a transition between birth and death, and there are several others. But the book is concerned with the transition between the zone between the moment of your death and then whatever comes next, which in the Tibetan tradition would be, of course, reincarnation. But if you're a Christian, it might be heaven or hell. So bardo kind of means that. And then I also took it to mean, you know, Lincoln himself was in a transition. He had to sort of quickly go from being a grieving father back to being a kind of active president. So the night is sort of almost like a, you know, for him, a chance to sort of take a breath and try to get back into the real world and out of that graveyard.
And the structure of the book, it's almost like you've invented a new form and it hasn't been written, it's been crafted almost. Tell us about how you decided on that structure.
Yeah, that's a great question. I wouldn't say decided unless decided was defined as, you know, kind of messing around for 3 or 4 months or maybe even a year. I think for me, I tried this book in a more traditional way many years ago, kind of a standard third-person narration, and it just didn't have any life in it, you know. And I mostly write short stories, and the one thing I've learned is if it's boring for me, it's going to be boring for the reader. So, or, you know, Flannery O'Connor, this great American writer, said once, a person can choose what he writes, but he can't choose what he makes live. So for me, the compositional method is always to just try to find a way to tell the story that makes me happy and makes me maybe confused and excited. So the short version is this was just a product of mucking around, trying to find a way to tell the story that was interesting to me. And in the end, the solution was to let it be this kind of chorus of monologues. Partly, I think, because, you know, in a sense, to me, that's the truest version of human life is a bunch of monologues. You know, if I look out the window here in London, there's 40 or 50 people walking by. The God's eye view of that is actually just 40 inner monologues, you know, at once. Sometimes they contradict each other. Sometimes they don't seem to even be observing the same reality. But it was just an exciting way for me to tell the story. It almost looked like a screenplay, some people said, or a theatrical script.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see the Braille version to see how it's translated to to a tactile form. But it certainly doesn't... Well, the audio version couldn't be narrated by just one person, could it?
Well, that originally that was the plan, and I just was so terrified of that because I can only do maybe two or three distinct voices. You know, I can do a guy from Brooklyn and, you know, a southern voice and a duck or something like that. So I didn't want to do it. So we had this wonderful young woman named Kelly Gilday in Los Angeles had the idea that maybe we could enlist actors, and she actually went off and made a spreadsheet, and she came back on the phone and said, well, we'll need 166 people. I said, well, can we get that? She said, well, we can try. So we got some really wonderful professional actors, and then some voice actors, and then some people from Random House and my agent, and then we got my family members. And so we just barely made the 166. But there's not a single double voice on the tape. So in other words, every voice that's in the book is represented by a distinct actor in the audiobook.
And would we know some of the actors who are involved?
Yes, I think Ben Stiller, Susan Sarandon, Don Cheadle, Miranda July, Nick Offerman, and Megan Mullally. And then David Sedaris plays one of the main parts. So there's quite a list. Maybe, probably, I would say 20 or 30 very famous actors are kind of headlining.
And they all recorded their lines individually.
That's right. They were never in the same. None of us were in the studio at the same time. And I think they ended up using, I think she told me 11 different locations. She would Skype, you know, you could go to Minneapolis and Skype in, and my parents went to New Orleans and Skyped in. So it was a Herculean effort, but not by me. Someone else did it all.
The unkempt gentleman was fussing over the small form now, stroking the hair, patting and rearranging the pale, doll-like hands.
As the lad stood nearby, uttering many urgent entreaties for his father to look his way, fuss over and pat him.
Which the gentleman appeared not to hear.
Then this already troubling and unseemly display descended to a new level of...
We heard an intake of breath from the Reverend, who, appearance notwithstanding, is not easily shocked.
He is going to pick that child up, the Reverend said.
And so he did. The man lifted the tiny form out of the...
sick box.
The man bent, lifted the tiny form from the box, and with surprising grace for one so ill-made, sat all at once on the floor, gathering it into his lap.
Sinking his head into the place between chin and neck, the gentleman sobbed, raggedly at first, then unreservedly, giving full vent to his emotions.
While the lad darted back and forth nearby, in an apparent agony of frustration.
Have you read the audio versions of your previous work?
Well, I had 10th of December, and then I think I did one other version. I did two other books. I didn't get through the whole catalog yet, but yeah, 10th of December was kind of the most highly produced one.
And when you're actually writing, is hearing it out loud, even internally, important to the writing process?
It's very important. I'm from Chicago, and for me, the kind of entrance into writing was to understand it as a form of performance. So when we were kids, we did a lot of kind of, you know, improvising and impersonating and that kind of thing. So I had a long time in my life when I was younger where I couldn't figure out how to write, really. I had a little bit of a false version of how to do it. But as soon as I thought, oh, yeah, it's just a performance, then it was easy. I don't usually read... Well, as you say, internally is more correct. I don't read aloud. You know, there's that little voice in your head that is a little actually more subtle than your speaking voice, you know, and can get into different registers and do different accents. So that voice is very active for me. So I tend to write, and then as I'm reading, I'm hearing that voice in my mind and adjusting the text to match the voice and so on. And then also, I've been, you know, when I go to colleges or I travel, I do, I try to develop performance versions of the stories where I learn to do the voices as well as I can and then kind of go back and forth to make it lively for the audience.
Now, let's note, you said you wrote short stories. You're described as the master of the short story. So it's a missed opportunity if I don't ask you this. RNIB have a writing competition each year. What are some top tips you would give to people who are potentially thinking about entering that competition?
Sure. Well, that's a great question. I think the For me, the big leap forward was when I realized that a short story is not necessarily, how would I say it? It's a strange little machine that we make. It's almost like a song or a poem. It has a resemblance to real life, but it isn't necessarily a linear representation of real life. So, or the other comparison would be to a joke. You know, a joke often doesn't have much to do with real life. It isn't. You know, it's more compressed and it's sillier. But when you're telling the joke, you're really concentrating on the last moment. You know, when you get to the punchline, if the person laughs, then you win, and if they don't, then you lose. So the story is a very similar medium, actually. There's usually one moment in the story that's kind of the payoff moment, and nothing else really matters except for that payoff. So to me, it was very useful to think of it as a kind of a machine, a strange little device that's there to create human emotion. The other more quotidian thing would be just that most of the story writers I know who are good, they just do a lot of revision. You know, it's not the case that they just blur something out, but you do blur something out, and then you go back to it again and again and again and try to find what it is really trying to say to you. And that's just a kind of a sweat equity sort of a thing. You're really doing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of rewrites to try to let the story talk to you directly.
How many times did you go back to and rewrite Lincoln and the Bardo?
It would be hard to count. It was a 4-year effort, and every section was rewritten, you know, at least dozens of times, and then whole sections were taken out and put back in, and things were moved around. And so it was kind of I'm sure thousands of drafts. I like that the model of writing that is, kind of led by iteration. So you keep coming back to it every day, and gradually it changes shape into what you like. The example I always use is if you had a hotel room, or let's say that I gave you an apartment, I bought it for you and gave it to you, and I furnished it nicely. Although that would be a nice gesture, you would go into the apartment and you wouldn't feel at home. This isn't your style. So revising is like if I let you, every day for 3 years, take out one thing that I bought for you and exchange it for something that you like better. You know, all the pictures, all the knickknacks, the blankets, everything in the house. After that 3 years, the place would have you in every cranny. You know, you would have totally infused that room with yourself. Rewriting is like that. You know, you throw down a first draft. That's kind of like that initial apartment. But then every day when you come back and make changes to taste, the thing starts to really have your essence in it. I can't do that unless I work on something for years and years over and over.
George Sanders, thank you so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Next on this special Booker Show, we go back to 2013, when the prize was won by Eleanor Catton. Now, I'm aware of the enormity of this question and the amount of levels that we will talk about in a moment, but initially, tell us about the book.
Well, from the very beginning of writing it, really, I've been describing it as an astrological murder mystery, which I suppose speaks to both halves of the book, both that it's kind of on the ground level. It's a pretty much straightforward classic adventure story murder mystery in which, various people disappear and are blackmailing other people and so on and so forth. On the other side of the coin, the book is a kind of a structural experiment, I suppose, in the sense that the action of the book, the plot of the book, has been patterned on the movement of, or the apparent movement, I should say, of the seven planets, the seven astrological planets, through the 12 signs of the zodiac over the course of a calendar year.
The book is illustrated with these astrological charts, and blind and partially sighted people won't get those in the book. Are they needed for the plot?
No, I wouldn't say so, necessarily. The way that the book is structured is that there are 12 parts, and each of the 12 parts takes place on a single day, spaced out around a single year. So In astrological terms, what that means is that the sun is in a different sign of the zodiac for each of the 12 parts. And just prior to every the beginning of every part, there is a horoscope, just a circular chart divided into 12, very much like the face of a clock, which shows the position of each of the seven planets by their astrological sigil. It's really just as a kind of a mental map, I suppose, to prime the reader to see who's moved, who's switched places, you know, who's kind of moved, and how the heavens have changed. But I think that it's not necessarily integral to understanding the definitely not understanding the or following the plot. It's more of a kind of a decorative element of the book, I suppose.
Just a clue to see which characters are in ascendance.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Do you believe in astrology yourself?
Well, I would say that maybe believe is the wrong verb to use, but I have a lot of respect for it. I gained a lot of respect for it, I would say, in terms of... over the course of researching the book. I think that before I'd done any kind of decent research into it as a subject, I'd always just assumed that it was, I don't know, some sort of rather feeble, you know, version of self-help, you know, that was always kind of presented in the newspapers in a very watered-down kind of even kind of pathetic kind of a way, and the more that I studied it, the more that I realized how incredibly culturally and historically rich it is as a system. You know, it wasn't very long ago that astrology and astronomy, for example, were indistinguishable from one another, and you know, kings and world leaders have had resident astrologers for many years and across many different cultures. So there's definitely a lot there to be wondered at and to be investigated.
The 12 men congregated in the smoking room of the Crown Hotel gave the impression of a party accidentally met. From the variety of their comportment and dress, frock coats, tailcoats, Norfolk jackets with buttons of horn, yellow moleskin, cambric and twill, they might have been 12 strangers on a railway car, each bound for a separate quarter of a city that possessed fog and tides enough to divide them. Indeed, the studied isolation of each man as he pored over his paper, or leant forward to tap his ashes into the grate, or placed the splay of his hand upon the baize to take his shot at billiards, conspired to form the very type of bodily silence that occurs late in the evening on a public railway. Deadened here not by the slur and clunk of the coaches, but by the fat clatter of the rain.
Now, one thing we won't get is the cover. I believe you came across that image accidentally in a library.
Oh, yes. Oh, so this is the end papers of the book, of the hardback, actually. This isn't in the paperback. But my mum found an old print that's actually from the 1870s, so it's about maybe 8 years after my book is set. And it's a print of a little etching that was made of the town of Hokitika, this is the gold rush town in which the novel is set. And I just immediately loved it. It's... What the print shows is the perspective on the west coast of the South Island of New Zealand from the ocean. So you're looking up this very wide, kind of flat-bottomed river towards the mountains. And in the foreground, you have all of the little false fronts of the kind of shanty houses and a couple of figures walking along the road in the extreme foreground. So it's quite a lovely print in that it shows the both the kind of the claustrophobia of the setting there, but also the extreme expansiveness with the kind of the sea giving way to the hills giving way to the mountains behind.
The plot using astrology. Now I'm going to try and phrase this question in a way that I can understand. Never mind you. Astrology sort of preordains your future, but the way you wrote, you didn't know how it was going to end when you were writing it.
No, that's true. I mean, I think that, you know, this is just part and parcel with how I work as a fiction writer. I feel that it's very, very important not to be able to see too far ahead, because if you do, as the writer, what ends up happening is that you start losing touch with what your reader is experiencing, because obviously they can't see or hear. And so if you're writing too knowingly, if you're kind of speeding up to get to the thing that you already know you're going to implant in 10 pages' time, there's a very good chance that your experience and the reader's experience will become divorced in a way that might end up kind of harming the overall effect of the book. So I definitely started blindly in that way, kind of knowing the general shape of what I wanted to do. I wanted to write a murder mystery. I wanted to have a kind of quite intensely plotted book with lots of, double blinds and people blackmailing people who end up getting blackmailed themselves and so on and so forth. But for all of that, I wasn't really sure exactly what would happen. And the way that the stars or the astrological scaffolding of the book played into that was, curiously enough, actually, I think, to my advantage, in the sense that I was working with archetypes. Essentially what the zodiac is a system of archetypes with not only 12 essential principles, which are embodied in my book in 12 men who each kind of are typical of one of the signs of the zodiac, but also of there are 7 moving parts, which are the 7 planets, and each of these parts bring an influence to bear upon the principle of the sign, if that makes sense. So, for example, I started the book on a particular day in January of 1866, because I really liked what was happening in the stars in the heavens at that time. And the first chapter of the book is called Mercury in Sagittarius, because at that time Mercury was in fact in Sagittarius when seen from the perspective of the Hokitika goldfields. And when I started thinking about how to begin the book, I looked at what happens when you put Mercury together with Sagittarius, when those two elements combine in a person's chart. And what I discovered was that Mercury, the planet that governs communication and reason and logic and words in a lot of ways, is coming into contact with Sagittarius as this principle of adventure and abandon, and enthusiasm. And when these two elements came together, what you got was the beginning of a story, so the beginning of somebody telling a story. So I thought, all right, I'll have somebody walking into a bar, which is how the book begins, and sitting down, and somebody begins to tell them a story. That's how I'll kind of make sense of those elements. So it was kind of like that all the way along. I had these little archetypes that were partial pictures, and I just had to think for a while until I could figure out how to make use of them in the context of the story.
Does that help your enjoyment when you're writing it? Because part of you is almost thinking, I wonder what's going to happen next.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, no, I think that it's crucial, actually, to remain in a state as a writer where you're surprising yourself. Because if you're not surprising yourself and if you're not having fun yourself, how can you expect somebody to be having fun or to be being surprised on their part?
Now, we are on RNIB's radio, so how important is it for you that your books are accessible to everyone, no matter what their sight condition?
I think that's hugely important. I haven't yet talked with anybody actually who has listened to the book rather than read it, and I'd be quite curious to hear how the experience is different. But I think it's a wonderful initiative.
Such was the perception of Mr. Walter Moody, from where he stood in the doorway with his hand upon the frame. He was innocent of having disturbed any kind of private conference, for the speakers had ceased when they heard his tread in the passage. By the time he opened the door, each of the 12 men had resumed his occupation, rather haphazardly on the part of the billiard players, for they had forgotten their places, with such a careful show of absorption that no one even glanced up when he stepped into the room.
So, Eleanor Catton, author of The Luminaries, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks very much. It was really fun.
And finally, on this Booker special edition of Read On, let's move it up to 2022's winner, Shehan Karim Atalaka. He won for the amazing book, The Seven Moons of Mali Almedia. But for now, let's hear the books of his life. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Yeah, I mean, there were several. I started with the Hardy Boys, Nancy Drew, Alfred Hitchcock and the Three Investigators, which people don't remember that well. But the one that I chose was simply because I acquired a bunch of them on eBay recently for my kids, but I think my kids are less interested in them than I am. It's the Choose Your Own Adventure series, which were written entirely in the second person. So you can track the tone of Mali Almeida directly to these. But also, so I bought a bunch of them for a bargain on eBay. And they're these books for, if you don't know, it's written, you are the detective, you're sitting here and there's a body in front of you and it outlines scenario. And then at the bottom of the page, you have to decide, do you interview the butler or do you interview the wife? And it forks, and this was done by Black Mirror recently. But I remember these in the 80s when they came out, they were something else. And I remember collecting a lot of them. And I think one thing, they're not as good as I remember them now that I'm reading them, but they did introduce me to genre fiction. So there were like sci-fi, space odysseys, there were horror bits, detective stuff. So I think that was my first initiation to it. And I'm enjoying going through them. But like I say, not quite what I remember them as. But I just hope my children are more interested than they have been. But
Okay, are Choose Your Own Adventure books available in audio? Well, yes, they are.
Are you ready for the secret Yeti knowledge? Or do you decide to wait?
Do you fire the propulsion charge? Or wait for the shark to go away?
There are a few attempts to make Choose Your Own Adventure books on YouTube, using the timestamps as direction points, but they're, let's say, a bit fiddly. But Audible, in 2019, released two Choose Cole books, The Abominable Snowman and Journey Under the Sea, that are fully interactive and controlled only through an Amazon smart speaker.
Warning. This story is different from other stories. You and you alone are in charge of what actually happens. There are dangers, adventures, and consequences, all depending on the choices you make. And the wrong choice could end in disaster, even death. Good luck.
As I say, there's only two, but as far as I can tell, they are free and enabled by telling your smart speaker, I won't say his wake-up word, to open Choose Your Own Adventure. And is there a book on a rainy day you go back to again and again to reread?
So I didn't know what you meant by on a rainy day. I tried to picture, but I interpreted it as curling up somewhere because it doesn't get very cold here. Sadly, and it does rain. It's the monsoon rain, but I sort of curl up and disappear into something or visit another world. And I think the Sandman series is what, which has recently been filmed. And but I remember the original comics from the 90s, and I collected them, and then got the entire set, the anthologies. That I keep turning to just because I think I never, every time I read it, there's something new. Perhaps I didn't understand it the first time. And so I have that experience every time. So it's like reading a fresh book, but also it's a graphic novel. So the different drawing styles and all that. And so I have the 10 set volume, and you can pick one up on the rainy day and go through that.
The cottage is small, with mud walls washed white with lime. Orpheus sleeps, naked, on a pile of skins laid over a rough frame.
Orpheus? Orpheus! Orpheus?
Aristaeus Agraeus enters through the open door on hairy haunches and goat's feet. He is in his early 40s, more fawn than satyr, with little horns and just slightly pointed ears.
Orpheus.
You are crying out in your sleep. Orpheus.
Huh? Oh, I'm sorry, Aristaeus.
Not to worry, lad. It reminds me of my wedding day. I was terrified.
You were married? I didn't know.
Her name was Antonomy. She was lovely.
What happened to her?
She died. Many years ago.
Oh. I'm sorry.
It was a long time ago. People die. You get over it. It's part of life.
Yes, I suppose it is.
Right. Get dressed. You're getting married. Here. Your best tunic.
Thank you.
You'll want your tortoise shell noise maker.
It's a lyre, Aristaeus. And I will make beautiful music with it to sing to my bride.
You ready?
Yes.
Orpheus and Aristaeus leave the cottage. It's a beautiful sunny day in ancient Greece. Flowers are in blossom, and small, brightly coloured birds sing in the trees.
It's been ages since I went to a wedding. Roast ox, eh?
No. No living thing is to die at my wedding, Aristaeus. I do not hold with sacrifice.
It is good to sacrifice before you wed. But you will have wine.
Of course, my friend. And dancing.
That's good. It wouldn't be a proper wedding without wine and dancing. There ought to be a sacrifice.
No!
They reach the path, which leads up the hill, towards the temple.
She's a very beautiful woman.
Yes.
You're very lucky.
Sandman by Neil Gaiman, Acts 1, 2 and 3 are available in audio as full cast dramatisations, but only on Audible. That was a clip from Act 3, narrated by James McAvoy, Neil Gaiman, David Harewood, Christian Shaw, Will Wheaton and more. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently you'd like to recommend.
Yeah, well, I feel I've misrepresented myself as a geek or nerd with my choices of the first two, Sandman fantasy and choose your own adventure sort of sci-fi. So this is actually more representative. I'm researching a new novel. It's kind of about my experiences in advertising and the corporate world. And so I just started reading books that had anything tangentially to do with advertising. Revolutionary Road by Richard Yates, which I'm 20 pages from the end. Hopefully tonight I can finish it. And it looks like it's going to rain as well. But yeah, it's not really about advertising at all. But it's this fantastic book about a marriage and about a couple. And I have a feeling once I finish it, I don't know how it ends, but I'm going to go right back and figure out how it was done, because it's quite masterful capturing of relationships in the 1950s, which sort of resonated to me as well. Though absolutely useless for my advertising research, but you know, a gem of a book.
The final dying sounds of their dress rehearsal left the Laurel players with nothing to do but stand there, silent and helpless, blinking out over the footlights of an empty auditorium. They hardly dared to breathe as the short, solemn figure of their director emerged from the naked seats to join them on stage, as he pulled a stepladder raspingly from the wings and climbed halfway up its rungs to turn and tell them, with several clearings of his throat, that they were a damn talented group of people and a wonderful group of people to work with. "It hasn't been an easy job," he said, his glasses glinting soberly around the stage. "We've had a lot of problems here, and quite frankly, I'd more or less resigned myself not to expect too much. Well, listen, maybe this sounds corny, but something happened up here tonight. Sitting out there tonight, I suddenly knew, deep down, that you were all putting your hearts into your work for the first time." He let the fingers of one hand splay out across the pocket of his shirt to show what a simple physical thing the heart was. Then he made the same hand into a fist, which he shook slowly and wordlessly in a long, dramatic pause, closing one eye and allowing his moist lower lip to curl out in a grimace of triumph and pride. "Do that again tomorrow night," he said, "and we'll have one hell of a show." They could have wept with relief. Instead, trembling, They cheered and laughed and shook hands and kissed one another, and somebody went out for a case of beer, and they all sang songs around the auditorium piano until the time came to agree, unanimously, that they'd better knock it off and get a good night's sleep. "See you tomorrow," they called, as happy as children, and riding home under the moon, they found they could roll down the windows of their cars and let the air in with its health-giving smells of loam and young flowers. It was the first time many of the Laurel players had allowed themselves to acknowledge the coming of spring. The year was 1955, and the place was a part of western Connecticut where three swollen villages had lately been merged by a wide and clamorous highway called Route 12. The Laurel Players were an amateur company, but a costly and very serious one, carefully recruited from among the younger adults of all three towns, and this was to be their maiden production. All winter, gathering in one another's living rooms for excited talks about Ibsen and Shaw and O'Neill, and then for the show of hands in which a common-sense majority chose The Petrified Forest, and then for preliminary casting, they had felt their dedication growing stronger every week. They might privately consider their director a funny little man, and he was, in a way. He seemed incapable of any but a very earnest manner of speaking, and would often conclude his remarks with a little shake of the head that caused his cheeks to wobble. But they liked and respected him, and they fully believed in most of the things he said. "Any play deserves the best that any actor has to give," he'd told them once. And another time, "Remember this. We're not just putting on a play here. We're establishing a community theater, and that's a pretty important thing to be doing."
Revolutionary Road is available in print, ebook, and audio commercially as read by Mark Bramhall. It's also available from RNIB Talking Books as read by Laurel Lefko. And Chihan Karunatilaka, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Robert. Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That's it for today's show. Remember to tune in at the same time next week for more book news, reviews and author interviews. And if you want to catch up with our previous shows, just type RNIB Read On into your favourite search engine. I can be found on Twitter at @talking_books. And remember to join me every day of the week on RNIB Connect Radio for our sister show Talking Books. The full schedule can be found at rnibconnectradio.org.uk.